exciting.
Of course,
isn't it? It's very quiet. Very well behaved. Looks like five. No, nearly.
Are we good to go, Sam?
Yep. All right. Good evening. Welcome to tonight's meeting. I'm Paula Reet, Mayor of Kingborough, and it's my pleasure to welcome everyone this evening on Monday the 1st of August. We don't have anyone in the public gallery with us this evening, but I'm sure we do have some people watching from home on our live stream on YouTube. As the time is now 5:30 p.m, I now officially declare the meeting open. I wish to advise that council meetings are recorded and made publicly available on our website. So in accordance with council's policy, I'll ask the general manager to confirm that the audio recording has started.
Confirm, Mayor.
Thank you. I wish to acknowledge the traditional custodians of this land, pay respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge today's Tasmanian Aboriginal community. Our attendees this evening are myself, Councillor Reet, Deputy Mayor, Councillor Westwood, Councillor Bastone, Councillor Cordova, Councillor Grace, Councillor Midgley, Councillor Street, and Councillor Wass. From our staff this evening, we have the General Manager, Mr Arnold, Chief Financial Officer, Mr Breen, Director of Engineering Services, Mr Reeve, Director of Governance, Recreation and Property Services, Mr Smee, the Acting Director of Environment, Development and Community Services, Mrs Salisbury, our Manager of Finance, Mr Jones, the Coordinator of Statutory Planning, Mrs Stevenson, our new planner, Miss Nessa Fitriani, welcome to your first council meeting. It's lovely to have you here with us. We also have our media and communications advisor, Ms Adams, and our executive assistant, Mrs Morton. We have two apologies this evening. We have apologies from Councillor Fox and also from Councillor Gladewright. Before I turn to the confirmation of the minutes on page one, I did just want to acknowledge the passing of a former Kingborough councillor, Mrs Susan Nolan, who passed away several weeks ago after a battle with cancer. Sue Nolan, I think, is very, very well known throughout the Kingborough community, and there were a number of us who attended her wake that she had, or celebration of life that she had, because she didn't want to have a funeral, she wanted to have a celebration, and it was a mark of her, the respect that she was held within our community and within, really, throughout Tasmania and beyond. She was, of course, the director of and founder of Blackmans Bay Children's Services, or Adventure Patch as it is now, and she held the position of director of that for 34 years before she retired. And she was also, of course, a Kingborough councillor from 2009 to 2014. So a number of us around the table had the honour of serving with Susan during her time here. But, of course, retiring from council and retiring from her role in childcare didn't mean that she retired from life. In fact, she's been very active helping with Kingborough Helping Hands. She was an avid sewer and would make many items for them that contributed to helping their fundraising. She was helping with gardening at Snug Village. She was incredibly active, and I feel very fortunate to have known her since my children went through childcare at her centre, and she was certainly a mentor for me when I had the education portfolio that included childcare. So I know that many people here knew Susan and held her in high esteem, so I wanted to place on record the contribution that she made. She was also a Citizen of the Year in the Kingborough Awards many years ago as well. So she is very well loved, and in her honour, two of her friends, Hester Van Niekerk and Bev Gibson, did some fundraising towards gynecological cancer and raised, I think last time I heard, it was over $15,000 in her memory. So that's a lovely legacy that they have left. And on behalf of everybody here at Kingborough Council, I certainly did convey my condolences to her husband, Pip, and children James and Zoe. So, I just wanted to place that on record this evening. Moving on now to page one, confirmation of minutes. The motion is that the minutes of the open session of council meeting number 14 held on the 18th of July 2022 be confirmed as a true record. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Mover in Councillor Midgley, seconder in Councillor Westwood. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? Motion is carried. Still on page one, workshops held since the last council meeting. We had a workshop on the 25th of July in relation to the biodiversity offset policy. Turning to page two, declarations of interest. Does any councillor have a declaration of interest? Councillor Bestow.
I was just looking for which application it actually was. I know many of the people along the shared driveway for one of the applications, so I won't be leaving the room.
So you'll still participate in the vote. Thank you. Any further declarations? Thank you very much. Transfer of agenda items. Is there any item that a councillor would like to move from open into closed session or closed into open session? No, thank you very much. We don't have any members of the public here, so there will be no questions without notice from the public. We do have a number of questions on notice from the public, and if you do wish to submit a question on notice, then I'd certainly encourage you to do that by emailing us at kc@kingborough.tas.gov.au. We had a question in relation to sports ground user fees from Mr Adam Smee, with an officer's response from Mr Daniel Smee. Question in relation to a DA for Benbow's Road, Oyster Cove, from Dr Don Ronson and Dr Val Ronson, with an officer's response from Mrs Stevenson. On page three, also in relation to the same DA at Benbow's Road, Oyster Cove, a question from Mr Betts and Mrs Susan Betts, and an officer's response from Mrs Stevenson. Turning now to page four, questions on without notice and councillors. Does any councillor have a question without notice? I've got Councillor Cordova and then Councillor Grace and then Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. My questions are about the General Manager's activities 27 June to 22 July, if I may. So the first question is just about the 6th of July attended Southern Tasmanian Councils Authority / Regional Climate Change Initiative Climate Change Communications Workshop, and my question is, what were the actions from this workshop and how is the RICI progressing?
General Manager.
Thank you, Mayor. Through you, Mayor, Councillor Cordova, I was invited to that workshop primarily to discuss communications for the work that the STTCA have been doing in the climate change area, the regional initiative, and the STCA have engaged Lee Arnold, no relation, to undertake some communications on behalf of the STCA to effectively spread the word on the good work that's been done.
Thank you. If I might just follow up with a second question, this time about the housing project, 14th of July, Housing Project Steering Committee meeting update. I'm interested to know what are some of the aims, objectives, actions or anticipated outcomes of the Housing Project Steering Committee?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. That relates, Councillor Cordova, to the work of the Hobart City Deal, which is ongoing. Obviously, the focus of that particular group is on provision of affordable housing and trying to identify any opportunities within the Greater Hobart area comprising the four councils that make up the Hobart City Deal.
And so are there any anticipated outcomes or actual action points that are worth noting?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. I suppose in trying to answer that question, Councillor Cordova, I would point to both the federal government and current state government's approach to endeavour to provide thousands of affordable homes over the next few years. And, of course, that comes with its challenges, as you'd be aware, not the least of which is identifying suitably zoned land and then working with the housing providers that are currently active in this space. In the Greater Hobart area, for example, work is proceeding in partnership with the state government and Centrecare Evolve and another number of other housing providers, but the focus is on trying to address the housing supply issues that are currently problematic for this state.
Thank you. And my final question is about the meeting with Traders in Purple. I'm seeking for a broad commentary on if everything, the purpose of the meeting, and also if everything with Kingston Park is progressing as anticipated.
General Manager.
Yep, through you, Mayor. Thank you, Councillor Cordova. That particular meeting was one of a regular series of catch-ups that I have with Traders in Purple. I'm generally accompanied by my colleague, Mr. Smee, and the Kingston Park partnership is proceeding, notwithstanding that from Traders in Purple's point of view, they're currently in mediation in the Planning Commission on their application for planning approval for Stage 3. But they have indicated that, subject to the outcome of that, they are already working on applications for the next two stages.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Councillor Grace.
I have a few.
Sure.
Please be patient. How are we going with the enterprise bargaining? Can I ask a question on where we're at with the enterprise bargaining?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Thank you for the question, Councillor Grace. We are currently in a situation where the ASU have just recently agreed that it is timely to proceed to another vote of staff on the offer that's on the table. The paperwork is being drawn up as we speak, and I'd expect that that will go to the vote of staff within the next week or two.
Thank you. I just want to reiterate again on the bus shelter at Conyngham or Channel Highway.
Yep. So, as you know, I've been away for a couple of weeks on sick leave, but I think Mr. Smee might have some further information.
I have some.
Okay. Well, let Mr. Smee tell you his bit first.
Thank you, Mayor. I don't have any further information to what I provided at the last council meeting on this matter, and that is that Metro consider the asset to be theirs. They have given an indication that they would be amenable to a plaque being installed on the bus shelter, and that offer has been put to the family, who I understand are considering the matter.
Thank you. Councillor Grace.
I've spoken to the family and they believe they've been bullied. They are not happy with that suggestion, which I quoted before.
Okay. I think we need to be careful about allegations of staff bullying members of the community.
I'm without prejudice, I'm quoting what I'm told by ratepayers. I don't want to step out of line, but I'm just quoting that is not what they want. And they haven't come back to council because they felt that council wasn't listening to them.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that. We have been listening, but our hands are tied because it is not our bus shelter, and so Metro have, as a gesture, have offered the installation of the plaque on their property. And I know this is a grey area about who owns the bus shelter, but Metro is saying it's theirs, so we don't have the power to go any further at the moment. I certainly don't want to cause any further concern to the family, but I had hoped we'd be able to resolve this and move on so that there is some recognition. And certainly that's what we've been working towards. If they don't feel that a plaque is appropriate, then if they could communicate that to us, that would be appreciated. But I don't know then where that leaves us.
They said they have, and we'll leave it at that because I don't want to... we'll just leave it at that, Mayor. But I'm passionate about that. We spent... I spent many, many hours with the community. I have written authority from members of the progress group that Metro do not own that bus and they're prepared to sign a declaration if we need it.
Point of order, Mayor. Oh, this is questions without notice from councillors. And I haven't heard a question.
Thank you. Can I make a suggestion, Councillor Grace? My suggestion would be that perhaps you make representations direct to Metro Tasmania then.
I have, okay. And they keep referring me back, and I came to you for support.
I did take it up with the CEO of Metro the first time I met her. So, okay.
Well, following that, then, can I ask another question?
Yes.
Relating to not so much that issue, but does this council support breast cancer people or council people with cancer?
You've asked that question before, and certainly, of course, we want to be supportive of people who are trying to raise awareness of a whole range of cancers. I've already spoken this evening about the magnificent fundraising efforts of two members of our community on behalf of one of our former colleagues. And certainly we made a contribution to that campaign, and of course we want to be able to support awareness and so on, but we also are limited in what we can do in terms of whether it's our property or not. And that's...
Could I ask what contribution we put into the Councillor Nolan's...
Yes, we made a $400...
We
made a $400 donation to the fundraising that was done on behalf of Susan Nolan.
And that didn't come to Council?
No, it was a mayoral donation.
Oh, thank you.
And it was done prior to her passing away, so that she was aware of it, that was a gesture that was done at her request.
Thank you. Just one other question in relating to the code of conduct, where council sat round this table and put a vote of no confidence in the code of conduct board and members of the code of conduct panel.
Mm-hmm.
Where has that actually gone? Because what sort of submission have we actually put? We certainly haven't had a workshop on that issue, to my knowledge. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Are you referring to the meeting in May of last year?
Council.
Because we did not put a notice of... There was no notice of motion that went through that... that expressed a lack of confidence. There was no action motion against the code of conduct panel. I'll just check with the general manager to make sure. I wasn't mayor at the time, but general manager, could you?
Through you, Mayor, I seem to recall, Councillor Grace, that you're referring to a council resolution that went to the Local Government Association of Tasmania during the term of office when Dean Winter was mayor. So that goes back some time.
Yes, you're quite right. I think it was that. But it did go through, and I'm just wondering where it's at now.
Thank you. General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. That action was followed up with and went to the Local Government Association of Tasmania.
Thank you. Thank you.
Councillor Midgley, I had you next on the list, and then Councillor Bastone.
Thank you, Mayor. Just so I don't forget, I have a question in closed session.
Thank you.
My first question is in regards to some further questions on the FOGO that I asked, and thank you very much for those responses. I'm wondering, do we promote the FOGO service in the rates notice?
Mr. Breen. I mean, sorry, Mr. Reeve. I was looking straight at him and said, Mr. Breen. Mr. Reeve, how could I forget that?
Thank you very much for the compliment, Mayor.
Is it?
No, no. We certainly do promote it through our waste and recycling guide. There is some information to put out through the rates notice. I don't believe there's anything specific about FOGO. I'd have to double check, but I don't believe we do put anything specific about that. But we certainly do promote it fairly heavily through the waste and recycling guide, which comes out every year for... everybody on the service.
Thank you very much. It would be great if we could we please consider promoting FOGO in the rates notice, noting the response there that there are currently 13,613 people eligible, and we have 7,937 registered. So we do have still a few more thousand that could uptake. So if that could be considered, that would be wonderful. Noting us as well, do we have any signage at Beretta promoting where the FOGO service is, noting that it's behind the Weybridge? And I couldn't see any signage when I was there.
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor, I might have to take that one on notice. I was pretty sure some had been put on. We'd actually, I guess, had a fairly low-key start to the FOGO that we actually put in place here, and we're looking at promoting it a little bit further. But I can certainly work out whether or not we need any improved signage. There'd certainly be some signage actually directing people where to go, but whether there's any signage that actually promotes a little bit further, I'd need to check.
Thank you very much. What is the process for schools to get FOGO?
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. So any, I guess, resident or business can potentially get FOGO if they're willing to actually put the, in that this includes schools, if they're willing to actually put the bin out on the day of collection. For schools, we do tend to talk to them one-on-one as to what they may be intending to actually use it for. So if they're just using it for their general school use there, then there would be a payment that would go with that side of things there. If they're actually using it for some class demonstration reasons, projects and so forth there, sometimes we can look at actually waiving the fees for those. So we have done that, for example, with recycling.
Thank you. So just further on that, are we actively then promoting that opportunity to schools?
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. Look, I think the opportunity is there for everybody, including businesses as well at the same time, provided they're willing to actually pay for the bin and put the bin out there. We don't actively go around and go to each individual business or each individual school and say, would you like to have FOGO? Many of them may not want to avail themselves of that particular service there. They would need to actually have the need for that. We can certainly understand the need they might actually have for recycling, maybe less so for FOGO, unless they're actually running a canteen or something similar.
Thank you. Have we considered FOGO bins at the Council Civic Centre and the Works Depot?
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor, similar sorts of reasons as to why we might have recycling here, which we do, as compared to having FOGO. So it's just about the generation of that type of material and how much there would be and whether that would be actually worthwhile doing or not worthwhile doing, but it can certainly be looked at.
Thank you. That would be great. The next question also relates to a question I asked, and it's fantastic around the implementation of a climate and biodiversity report card that Council have said that is a good thing. I am wondering, it states, just looking at that, response from the officer, excuse me, Mayor, it says a report card will be delivered annually. Would that be as part of the annual report, or I'm just wondering when that would be?
I'm not sure what the plan was, Mrs. Salisbury. Yep, it was on. I think no, you just turned it off again. Okay.
Need practice.
And, and the rain is making it hard to hear, actually.
Yeah. Thank you, Mayor. We're really just in the planning stages for the report card, so perhaps we could take that one on notice until we've actually worked out how we're going to deliver the report card. It was certainly something that had been on the agenda that we thought was a good idea, and we're on to it.
Mm. Great. Thank you very much. A few more questions, Mayor. Alacasurinas have been removed at Home Avenue in Blackmans Bay. I'm wondering if council staff are aware of this, and was this part of the development conditions to retain those or remove those, I guess?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Councillor Midgley, yes, council staff have had that matter brought to their attention. They are inspecting the site and also checking with the approval that runs with that property to make sure that the two align.
Great, thank you very much for that. Mayor, this has been a topic that we haven't been able to miss in the media, so I feel it's remiss of me not to ask some questions regarding this. What comms have been provided to clubs following the council's decision on sports ground user fees?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor, the intent in relation to the communications with clubs following council's decision was that it would be an ongoing conversation in the lead up to the implementation that won't occur until the 1st of July next year, and if you're a summer club, it won't occur until the 1st of October next year. So there is an ongoing process, and that process started when our former strategic recreation planner did make himself available to attend a number of club committee meetings, which he did, and then there will be ongoing, as I say, communication that's both with clubs, and I know our administration officer for recreation services has been in touch with all clubs and offering to provide an opportunity to meet and provide any feedback, and we also do intend to do some broader community engagement around the matter.
Thank you. I'm just wondering about the transparency of that engagement and if that will be brought to councillors.
Mr. Smee.
Certainly we can provide a summary of the engagement that has occurred. I did send out recently to councillors a summary that was provided by our former strategic recreation planner as to the work that he'd done in that space, and as I say, the conversation will be ongoing over the next 12 months, and at some point we can bring a summary of the further engagement to council.
Thank you very much. And a final question regarding a policy that will be developed in regards to the user fees. What is happening with that, or regarding an update or any engagement around that one?
Mr. Smee.
Through you, Mayor. So council has an existing sports ground user policy. What that policy doesn't contain is any commentary around user fees. So the previous decision of council in relation to a review of that policy was to defer a review pending the introduction of fees. So the ongoing engagement that I referred to just earlier will form part of how we include a user fees component as part of our sports ground user policy, and I wouldn't expect that would be brought to council until after the election.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Councillor Bastone.
Thank you very much, Mayor. Do we have a date for the opening of the park and ride at the Algona Road Channel Highway intersection or roundabout?
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. It is due soon, but I don't have a specific date at this stage, then the General Manager has some more information that I don't have.
No.
All
right. It just says the middle of the year, so I was hoping it would be very soon by the...
I would hope so, but not being our project, not quite aware of it.
Okay, and my second question, which is probably also to Mr. Reeve through you, Mayor. When will the barrier be installed at the Uniting Church in Woodbridge on Thomas Road boundary that's been promised for a number of years now?
Mr. Reeve.
Through you, Mayor. Yes, it's still on the list, Councillor Bastone there. So I did mention to you that we would be doing that as soon as we can. Unfortunately, one of my staff members has been off for an extended period of time and it's sitting under her purvey at the moment there, but she hopefully will be back in the next couple of weeks, and I will remind her to get onto that one as quickly as possible.
Councillor Walsh.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. I'd ask whether the General Manager, if he would elaborate on the Teams meeting he had with the Office of Racing Integrity.
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. Councillor Walsh, thanks for the question. The Office of Racing Integrity are undertaking an audit of greyhound racing establishments from a point of view of confirming or otherwise whether those registered greyhound trainers in Tasmania have all the appropriate approvals. In this case, obviously, that would include from the local council. When I was first notified of the invitation, I did some homework, and it appears from our records that we don't have any registered within Kingborough, but I will await with interest the outcome of the audit from Racing Integrity to see whether they confirm that is the case.
Thank you.
Any further questions without notice? If not, we'll move on. Thank you very much. Questions on notice from councillors. There were two questions on page 4 from Councillor Midgley, one in relation to FOGO with an officer's response to Mr Reeve, and the second one in relation to the implementation of a climate and biodiversity report card with a response from Ms Quinn. The open session of council now adjourns, and the planning authority of council commences at 5:59 p.m. So we're moving to page 6. It is DA 2022-64, development application for the demolition of existing buildings and construction of dwelling, ancillary dwelling, visitor accommodation and associated works and roadworks infrastructure on the Channel Highway at 4101 Channel Highway Flowerpot, with a recommendation on page 38. And I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, please. Anyone?
Yeah.
Oh, moved Councillor Wass, seconded Councillor Street. Councillor Wass.
Thank you, Mayor. I hadn't prepared anything because I didn't think I was going to be moving this, but so be it. I don't have an issue with that. It's one of those that was anticipated there would be a good number of residents that objected to it. Some living in the close proximity and some living quite a distance away. I think staff have covered it quite well, and in their recommendation, the conclusion states that the application has been assessed against the development standards for rural resource zone and relevant codes in the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme 2015, and the application has demonstrated compliance with the acceptable solutions and performance criteria and is recommended for approval with conditions, and those conditions are listed. I think the beauty of this is that it's going to take a two-storey house away and make it a one-storey or a ground-level house, which means, and I know I did receive a couple of emails saying that it would be seen from the Doncaster Channel more and it would be intrusive. I don't believe that's to be the case, because it would be not as high, it would be hidden, I won't say hidden, it would meld, if you like, into the background, and it wouldn't be like a sore thumb on a pumpkin. It really, I think, will disappear from sight unless you're really looking for it. But I commend the recommendation. I think staff have covered all aspects that I was concerned with, and I'm happy to support the recommendation.
Sorry. Thank you, Councillor Wass. It's not going very well, is that? Okay. Councillor Cordover.
Thank you, Mayor. This is a large development in the rural resource zone in a quiet and scenic part of the municipality. The dwelling has a total floor area of 620 square metres, plus an ancillary dwelling of 60 square metres, plus a visitor accommodation building of 142 square metres, plus a second access to a tricky part of the Channel Highway. In the assessment checklist for the development within the rural resource zone, you can see, starting on page 85, there are multiple clauses that comply, but there are also 17 areas of non-compliance for which the planning authority's discretion is required. Of particular note is the failure to comply with clause 26.4.2 setback A1, A2 and A4, this is on page 86, and failure to comply with site distance at access, clause E5.6.4 on page 92. A number of those 17 areas of non-compliance are inconsequential, in my opinion, such as E6.7.3, where the non-compliance relates to vehicular passing bays not being every 30 metres. Let's turn our attention firstly to clause 26.3.2 on page 14, visitor accommodation. The report acknowledges that this proposed building does not comply with the planning scheme because the visitor accommodation is not contained within an existing building, and therefore we look to the performance criteria. The report claims that the visitor accommodation will not impact residential amenity or privacy of adjoining properties. However, we see that performance criteria P1 clearly states that visitor accommodation must satisfy all of the following criteria. I won't read them all, but Importantly, D says not adversely impact the safety and efficiency of the local road network or disadvantage owners or users of private rights of way. And speaking to that point, the Hubble traffic assessment from February 2022 concludes that the development is not expected to generate any adverse safety or efficiency concerns. However, there's some consternation about the timing of that report and also in the multiple representations that were provided. And when I talk about the timing, that relates to February 2020. In the multiple representations provided, one of which was detailed with some 100-plus pages of concerns, there was a clear thread detailing how this proposed development would negatively and adversely impact the safety and efficiency of the local road network. Page 16 now, looking now at setbacks, clause 26.4.2 on page 16. The acceptable solution A1 is for a building setback from frontage of no less than 20 metres. However, the visitor accommodation component of this proposal does not comply with the planning scheme, being setback only 7.47 metres. The acceptable solution A2 for the building setback from side or rear boundaries should be no less than 50 metres. However, in this proposal, both the dwelling and the visitor accommodation do not comply, being setback only 9.83 metres from the rear boundary, at its minimum, and 20 to 25 metres at its maximum. The visitor accommodation setback is only 16 metres from the rear, so it does not comply because it doesn't reach the 50 metres. I note on page 18 the report lists among the reasons that the proposed variation with the planning scheme can be supported is because the dimensions and configuration of the site, quote, make it difficult to achieve complying setbacks. So to me, this is where I respectfully take issue, or I have a divergence of opinion with the officer's report here, because to me the difficulty of the configuration of the site points to the fact that non-compliance cannot be supported rather than the opposite. I think the fact that the site is difficult and constrained doesn't to me indicate that we should let this through and ignore the issue of setbacks. I think it's the opposite, that it indicates that this is not an appropriate site for a development of this proposed scale. Moving towards the end of my remarks, E5.6.4, which is on page 22, this is about the site distance at access. On page 24, it's worth noting that the new access does not comply with the safe intersection site distance shown at table E5.1. However, it can be supported due to the findings of the traffic impact assessment by Hubble, which talks about, from a traffic engineering and road safety perspective, the traffic from the development is not expected to create any adverse safety or efficiency concerns. End quote. Long story short, it seems to be that, according to Hubble, it's one vehicle passing every 45 seconds, which leaves enough room for the supposed 15 cars per day to enter and leave that access. Page 31 now, clause E25.7.1, building height. This is basically the fact that this is 5.65 metres above ground level, but the planning scheme allows for only 5 metres. However, I think in this case that's where those performance criteria come in, and I think that's a reasonable point. I, of course, paid close attention to the notes listed at 2.6, other matters, on page 37, as they relate to the swift parrot and the collision risk of large areas of glass in buildings, and how the main dwelling in this proposal contains a very high ratio of glazing to solid walls from several elevations. I just wanted to note that where they did study this at one skyscraper in Chicago, they found that between 1978 and 2004, 31,000 individual birds were found dead from 114 different species.
Time and relevance, I'd say.
may I please ask to conclude? It's less than a small paragraph.
I'll need to motion. Moved Councillor Midgley, seconded Councillor Bastone. All those in favour? Against? Motion is carried. Got about a minute.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor, for your indulgence. Each year, 2% of the swift parrot breeding population is killed by collision, so it's good that there's mention made of the amelioration with glazing. In this, my conclusion is this. I note that the proposal meets a number of points of the development standards for the Rural Resource Zone and the relevant codes in the Kingborough Interim Planning Scheme. However, on balance, due to the failure to comply with the planning scheme at clause 26.4.2 setbacks, I will be voting against this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Do I have further speakers? Councillor Street, I thought you'd been quiet tonight.
Turn it on.
Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Look, I'll keep my remarks very brief. I am I've taken careful note of the report and I accept the advice of our planning staff, and I thank them for their very carefully written report and for the suggestions and conditions that they have provided to ensure that the development application is appropriately conditioned. My reason for speaking, rather than simply letting this matter go to a vote, is I must take some issue with Councillor Cordova's contribution, in that he continually says that the development application is contrary to the planning scheme. The reality is that our planning scheme is a performance-based planning scheme, as we all know. Simply because a matter doesn't meet the acceptable solution does not mean that it is contrary to the planning scheme. We'll have to look to the performance criteria. It's my submission that in this case, that's exactly what our planning staff have done. They have gone to the performance criteria, and as I think the report very succinctly indicates, this development application, appropriately conditioned, does meet all of the performance criteria. It meets the planning scheme, our performance-based planning scheme, and the application ought to be supported on that basis.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Further speakers, Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. These matters, I think, as Councillor Westwood has often said many times, we sit as a planning authority, and then many community members email councillors. I think I've lost count of how many emails, and sorry to those that I haven't replied back to, advocating on certain matters that are important to that. And I just want to acknowledge that it is important that we have local community advocacy. They know their local environment. They certainly know probably their local traffic conditions, sometimes maybe more than a traffic assessment report, and they sometimes know the blind corners and the spots that are a hazard that might not be picked up. So I just want to acknowledge that and thank them all for putting their representations forward. Councillor Cordova has pointed out a number of non-compliance, and noting that there is discretionary on that, noting that staff can look at that discretion and therefore, as Councillor Street said, make a very detailed, informative and thorough report. The thing, just a few questions from me in regards to on page 14, regarding the acceptable solutions, A1, the visitor accommodation must comply with all the following: is accommodated in existing buildings, provides for parking and manoeuvring spaces, has a floor area, etc. Performance criteria P1, that visitor accommodation must satisfy all the following: not adversely impact residential amenity and privacy of adjoining properties. I guess that's the one where it is discretionary and that the community has put a lot of comments forward stating that it will adversely impact their residential amenity, and some stating privacy, and also the intensity that respects the character use of the area and not adversely impact the safety and efficiency of the local road network or disadvantage owners and users of private rights of way. And then it states in the proposal that it's not complying. The visitor accommodation is not contained in an existing building. The single visitor accommodation will be able to accommodate 4 visitors, etc. on that information there. When I read that, could I just get an explanation of staff then to how, if we have these proposals that it's not complying, especially in regards to the visitor accommodation is not contained in an existing building, that therefore we are removing a current dwelling and creating 3 other dwellings and a visitor accommodation. I'm just wondering some explanation of that. I'm sorry if it's in the report and I could have just read it and explained it more myself, but if I can just get some understanding, and I think for the community it would be good to understand that as well.
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. I think I'm understanding your question, but essentially what the planning scheme does is with, as Councillor Street has already alluded to, there are acceptable solutions and performance criteria. Effectively, in terms of visitor accommodation, what the scheme's trying to say is that if you have an existing building and you're using that for visitor accommodation, then you've ticked that box, if you like. If you don't have an existing building and you're building a new building for that purpose, for that use, then there is that discretion and those those issues that you've listed under the that are listed under the performance criteria, which council needs to consider. In this case, and it's not uncommon at all for people to build separate visitor accommodation units, and quite often you'll have a dwelling on the site, and then they'll construct a number of cabins and things like that, which are all built in new buildings. So it just means that it becomes assessed under the performance criteria, and there's those issues that need to be addressed. It could be, for example, that somebody might put in 25 cabins, which obviously would have a far more significant impact than one small cabin might have. So that's where the discretion comes in terms of council in considering all of those impacts. So it doesn't mean you can't have visitor accommodation in a new building. It just then means that we have to consider how that development is done and how that relates to the performance criteria for this clause and also for some other clauses, including the normal development standards for setbacks, heights, those kind of things. I hope that answers your question.
That did answer my question. Thank you for interpreting that. In regards to, comments regarding the traffic assessment report and many representations around that they don't feel that the extra driveway and the placement of that driveway is safe, could I get some staff comment on that, please, Mayor?
Ms. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. So in relation to access, as a general rule, the acceptable solution is that you have one access per property, and there are a number of reasons for that, but in certain circumstances it's quite appropriate and sometimes even preferable to have multiple accesses, particularly in rural areas where you have large blocks with long frontages. It can be quite reasonable to have a second access. Where you have multiple uses on a site, sometimes separating the access for those multiple uses can be useful. So there is that performance criteria for that to occur. In this, so having a second access in itself is not necessarily a prohibition. In this particular case, as is the case with a lot of developments, we require assessments by qualified traffic experts. The applicant in this case has supported their application with a submission by the traffic engineer. As with all professional consultants' reports that come through to the council, we assess those reports ourselves for, and so we have, our development engineers have assessed those that report. In this particular case, being the Channel Highway, it is a state government road, not a council road, so there has been communications with the Department of State Growth in relation to that. So the Department of State Growth and council's own development engineers have assessed the traffic report submitted and are satisfied with the content and the conclusions of that report, and the second access has been assessed against the relevant standards in the planning scheme, and the decision, the assessment is that it's compliant with those performance criteria.
Thank you. Thank you. Noting as well, and again raised by representations, that the traffic assessment report was completed in May 2020. Quite sure that was during COVID. Was it COVID lockdown? I can't remember. That was stated by some representation. So I'm just wondering at all, do we really believe that that's a current traffic assessment report?
Sorry. I thought it said on page 15 it was February 2022. Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. I think the issue may be that the report that was submitted to Council was dated February 2022, but I think within that report some of the survey data that was taken was from May 2020 or whatever that date was. So I think that might be where the confusion is. I think the point is that the report has been assessed by the Department of State Growth and by Council's development engineers, and they're satisfied with the assumptions and conclusions within that report. So...
I've got Councillor Grace and then Councillor Bastone. Councillor Grace.
It's unusual for me to raise issues regarding a development application, but this particular one worries me deeply. A, as Councillor Cordover, the size of it. I've read Hurdle's report regarding upgrade of the road, and I'm fully aware of that road because I've travelled on it every month for the last 10 years or more, and it's not a nice piece of road down there. And the thing that's really thrown me right off this report is the fact that, okay, Dyer has said, okay, we're fine, no worries. But then if you go to page 44, and it says on the top, assessment by Hurdle Traffic, February 2022. And it must be to the satisfaction and approval of the Director of Engineering and Services. So it's then thrown back to our engineers, not State Growth. So therefore, under those terms, I can't support it, because we then will be liable if there is a major accident through the approval. And I find that very difficult, because that's a very, very important issue, Mayor, if you take the time to read that, and no doubt you have.
I think Mrs. Stevenson's got a response to that.
Yes, through you, Mayor. In relation to that condition is not in relation to the crossover access on the Channel Highway. That's actually in relation to the construction works internally on the site. So it's the access driveway, the car parking, and the circulation areas internal to the site. So that's why that's in relation to Council's approval, because they're the works internally. Mm-hmm. There would be a condition requiring a permit from State Growth for the construction works in the Channel Highway Road Reserve, and those works would need to be to the satisfaction of the Department of State Growth.
Thank you, Ms. Stevenson.
Can I just say, Madam
Councillor Grace,
I see it different than our planner, unfortunately.
Okay.
If it went to a court of law, if somebody was killed coming out of there, who would they actually sue? So, I mean, I've put my contribution, and I know you've got different views, but that's exactly how I see it.
Okay. Thank you, Councillor Grace. Councillor Bastone.
Thank you, Mayor. My question through you is, will there be a limit to the number of days the visitor accommodation can be used?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. Do you mean the number of days of the year it can be used, or the maximum length of stay?
The maximum they can use.
The maximum length of stay for visitors?
The maximum stay for visitors, yes.
Yeah, so there should be, I'll just see if I can find the condition. So the normal condition that we require is 3 months, which...
Condition
20... So condition 20 in the recommendation is the visitor accommodation is for short-term stay only. Accommodated guests must not stay any longer than a total of 3 months on any one occasion. That's a standard condition we put in all visitor accommodation permits.
Thank you. And my worry is, or part of it, is that this will in fact all be used for visitor accommodation. And I'm wondering how we're going to police that, and what will happen if indeed... this is the case, that their intention is for it to be all visitor accommodation and the owners will use it, you know, a very short time themselves.
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. In relation to the application that's been applied for is for a dwelling and the separate visitor accommodation. That is what we are considering. That is what we are approving. Any development or use, if anyone is to use it contrary to what the permit has been issued for, then they would be subject to normal compliance action or requirements to comply with the planning permit or seek an alternative permit for the use that they're intending to undertake. But at this stage, that's what they're applying for, that's all we can consider, and that's what it's conditioned accordingly.
I understand that, but what I'm wondering, what is the penalty if they just go ahead and use it as visitor accommodation? Do we set the penalty? Is there a set penalty? The residents feel very strongly that it is all going to be accommodation, and I'm just wondering how we can reassure them that even if this is the case, what sort of penalty will these people have to pay?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. So there is a compliance process under the Land Use Planning and Approvals Act, and so there are different mechanisms through that, through notices of intentions to issue enforcement notices and so forth. So I can't give you an answer as to what penalty there would be because it would have to go through that compliance process, but certainly there are avenues for compliance to be undertaken, and it would be a decision, obviously, depending on how it went through that path by the magistrate at the magistrate's court. So there are penalty units specified in the legislation, but it would obviously be a subject to a ruling of a court to determine what the penalty actually would be.
Thank you. And I must say that having driven it yet again today, I drive that road a lot. I'm backwards and forwards to Middleton frequently. And in pouring rain today, I tried to get out of the driveway that was their driveway where I pulled over to have a look at the site, and it was almost impossible to get in and out. The traffic was heavy. It was around school pick-up time, and I just couldn't support an application that has two driveways in such an incredibly dangerous stretch of road. It's narrow and particularly difficult lines of sight. So I'm just putting that out there now. I won't be supporting this.
Thank you, Councillor Bastone. Do I have any further speakers? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. A further question regarding the traffic impact assessment report, and I understand that there has been qualified people look at this report, but in regards to being an updated traffic assessment report that was completed later than the 2020 date, perhaps at a time that Councillor Bastone just said in regards to school pickup times and things like that, why did we not ask for a traffic impact report that actually was more current, provided at peak times and things like that?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. As I said before, the relevant officers at the Department of State Growth and Council Zone Development Engineers have assessed the application. I think it's important to note that the intensification of use of the access is relatively low. So we're talking about an individual single dwelling and ancillary dwelling for one access, and a visitor accommodation being just one two-bedroom unit for the other. So visitor accommodation for that would be equivalent to the similar traffic movements for a residential use. So the standards for the number of traffic movements expected from a dwelling would be 7 to 8 traffic movements per day. That's the standard that's considered for those uses. So on the basis of the relatively low number of traffic movements anticipated and the other evidence available from the assessment by the traffic engineer, both the independent traffic engineer, the Department of State Growth and Council's engineers were satisfied that there was enough information and proper assessment done to support the conclusions of that report.
Any further speakers? Before I put the motion, just for my contribution, I just also wanted to acknowledge, as Councillor Midgley did, there have been many representations that I think we've all received over the last few weeks from members of the community, and likewise I haven't had an opportunity to respond to everyone because I've been away unwell, but I thank everyone for their comments. Look, this is one of those difficult issues, but I do think that we have to take the advice of the people who have qualifications in the areas that have made the assessments in relation to this and have assessed it as being able to comply with the planning scheme. There are some discretions, but I think Mrs. Stevenson has given us some comfort today about the way that those discretions have been assessed. It's always one of those ones where we say, well, you know, those of us who sit around this table don't have planning qualifications, and so we do need to rely on those who have
the expertise in this area, and so I'm satisfied that they have taken all of those comments into consideration, and indeed I think it's a very thorough report that does address a lot of the responses to the many representations that were received. So I will be supporting the recommendation as put forward today. Councillor Wass, did you want to sum up?
Thank you, Mayor. I'd just like to touch on two things that you've touched on, one of them. The local road network was mentioned by several councillors. There's an independent qualified report, consultant's report, and unless anyone around this table is a qualified road traffic engineer, I'm sorry to say you don't know what you're talking about. And I remember being told that as a newly elected councillor
That's
many
a point
years
of
ago.
Order. Councillor Wass is out of order.
Sorry, what's the point of order? I didn't hear what Councillor Wass said, so you'll have to help me out. Councillor Cordova.
If I might, yeah, so I think if I'm interpreting it correctly, Councillor Grace's point of order is under 23E. A statement is made by a councillor speaking to the councillor raising the point of order if he believes that it is likely to be offensive to a councillor or other individual.
Yeah. My problem is I didn't hear what Councillor Wass said. So, Councillor Wass,
we don't know what we're talking about.
Thank you, Mayor. I said that unless councillors are qualified traffic engineers, then we have to take what the qualified traffic engineer has provided.
Yeah.
There's no debate.
Yeah. I don't uphold the point of order because that's not... Councillor Wass is not casting a dispersion on anyone. He's stating a fact. So there are none of us here who are either qualified planners or traffic engineers. So I don't accept the point of order. Councillor Wass, can you continue?
Thank you, Mayor. And yes, both Department of State Growth and Council Development engineers concur with the report. So it's a non-event, to put it bluntly. The other thing that you touched on, Mayor, and I totally agree, that is our planning scheme are the experts on this development application. They've researched it, they've accepted the responsibility to investigate and made recommendations. If we value our planning staff, I think we've got to listen to their recommendations from time to time, and I wholeheartedly support their recommendation that this development application does in fact meet our planning scheme, and therefore we should be voting for it. Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, Councillor Wass. I will put the recommendation. It's as printed on page 38 of the agenda. All those in favour? Against? Show of hands is required. All those in favour? Is Councillors Wass, Midgley, Street, Westwood and Reet? Those against? Is Councillors Grace, Cordova and Bastone? The motion is carried. Turning now to page 100, DA 2022-150, development application for change of use from residential to visitor accommodation at 110 Ferry Road, Kettering, with a recommendation on page 107. Do I have a mover and a seconder, please? Moved Councillor Street and seconded Councillor Westwood. Councillor Street.
Thank you, Mayor. Before us is a change of use application for a dwelling from residential to visitor accommodation. On the basis of the report that's been provided by staff, I believe that the development application does fit within the planning scheme. I expect that there will be some commentary this evening around housing availability and the like. What I would say in anticipation of that criticism is that this dwelling is already a holiday home. And there's an application for it to be used for visitor accommodation, and that impact is not going to have much greater impact on the surrounding area than its current use already does, and I think that that's outlined quite succinctly in the planning scheme, nor would us refusing this application, if it were possible for us even to do so, have an impact on housing availability in the municipality. On those basis, I'm happy to support the council staff's advice and the recommended motion.
Thank you, Councillor Street. Do I have further speakers on the motion? Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. This is a whole dwelling, a three-bedroom family home on a residential street on approximately 1 acre. The proposal applicant is Pink Pig Productions Pty Ltd, which is a limited by shares Australian proprietary company located in New South Wales. If they have a website, I couldn't find one. Access to the site is from Ferry Road by shared carriageway passing through four neighbouring lots. The site is zoned environmental living and has several code overlays, including E3.0 land slide code. There are four properties adjoining the subject site, including Crown Land to the south. I strongly recommend councillors familiarise themselves with the seven zone purpose statements for the environmental living zone listed on page 103, for which this proposal might meet 14.1.1.6, but I believe it actively infringes upon or fails to respond to the other six. The officer's report states that, quote, given the size of the property, the location of the existing buildings used to accommodate the guests and dense vegetation subject property and the neighbouring properties, the proposal will not impact the privacy or seclusion of the local residents who live in the area. I found this that I differ in that opinion, considering that it directly contradicts the explicit opinion stated in each of the eight representations received from the neighbours of the property. So we have a situation where there are clearly some conflicting points of view there. The fact that to get onto this property you need to pass through the neighbouring lots along a shared carriageway proves beyond any reasonable doubt in my mind that privacy and seclusion will be impacted by having strangers, be they paying guests, contractors, property managers or otherwise, frequently moving up and down this shared space. We need to determine if there is any loss of residential amenity to the adjoining lots. If there is, then this proposal fails to comply with Planning Directive No. 6 that came into effect on the 1st of August 2018. We're told in the report at page 105 that the following issues raised by the neighbours, those are the local residents who will be most intimately and uniquely affected by this proposal, that the following issues are irrelevant to the planning scheme. So this is on page 105. Access to the Kettering Point track, as this is owned by Crown, that is not relevant. Trespassing is not considered relevant to the planning scheme. The impact on residential security is not a matter for the planning scheme, nor is awareness of native species. Property safety is not considered a planning matter either. The planning scheme might be defined by what it isn't more than what it is. And finally, on the issue of noise. With respect to noise, the report notes that, quote, the visitor accommodation use is unlikely to exceed the noise levels permitted under the planning scheme. Council's environmental health officer has advised that the noise generated by visitor accommodation is identical to the noise generated by a residential dwelling. This is another fascinating assertion that warrants the presentation of evidence. For example, if it were truly the case that short-stay accommodation guests are likely to cause identical levels of noise to residential tenants, then why is it that a Google search of Airbnb guest noise complaints reveals 6,500 articles from reputable news organisations, mostly around the globe.
Here's point of order, relevance.
If I might, Mayor, I'm merely refuting what I believe is an inaccurate claim made on page 105 of this report by presenting evidence to the contrary, something that this report does not do.
Do you wish to ask evidence. A question, maybe Mrs Stevenson, then you can give her the opportunity to respond to that?
I don't particularly want to ask a question.
Oh.
Are you upholding
the
point?
Because you know everything already.
No, I don't need to ask a question.
Okay.
Are we upholding that point of order, or may I continue?
You can continue.
Thanks very much. Here are the headlines. Airbnb host fuming after guests cause £5,000 in damage. Raging US landlord loses battle for Airbnb property's noisy guests. Or, as we should all be aware, just 3 weeks ago in Hobart City Council in Sandy Bay, a waterfront house being rented out as a party house by on Airbnb by one of Tasmania's most notorious serial rapists.
Okay.
Was subsequently.
I am actually now going to call you a point of order on relevance.
Okay.
Because we need to get back to the assessment of the development application again that we have before us.
Yep.
As a planning authority, and you've just tested my patience a little bit going down that rabbit hole.
Thank
a little
you.
Bit too far.
Thank you. Not a problem. So back to the report, and we're talking about noise, and I fundamentally disagree because I think that noise is an issue. The report says it isn't an issue, so there's that. And I think that most other people would agree that short-stay accommodation noise can be an issue. Fundamentally, as a planning authority, this proposal is classified as a permitted use. However, it relies on performance criteria to comply with the scheme provisions and is therefore discretionary. And so for Councillor Street's edification, the definition of discretion is the freedom to decide what should be done in a particular situation. So I do note that Councillor Street thinks I don't understand what performance criteria are. I do, and I'm noting them. And right now, we must have regard to the following. Visitor accommodation must be compatible with the character and the use of the area and not cause an unreasonable loss of amenity. Having regard to the privacy of adjoining areas, any likely increase in noise to adjoining properties, the scale of the use and its compatibility with the surrounding character and uses of the area, retaining the primary residential function of the area, the impact on the safety and efficiency of the local road network, and finally, any impact on the owners' and users' rights of way. It is my opinion that the proposal from Pink Pink Productions fails to comply with A, B, C and D of those performance criteria that came into effect on the 1st of August 2018 in the Planning Directive No. 6, and therefore I will be voting against the proposal. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Mrs Stevenson, did you want to make a comment just to clarify Councillor Cordova's statement about the Planning Directive that came into effect that he's just referred to, that he believes is... this has been assessed inconsistently with?
Through you, Mayor. Yes, in relation to PD6, the proposal actually is compliant with the acceptable solutions under PD6. So if you have a look at the page 112 in the agenda, the planning directive standards are specified there. The first clause, which is the clause that I think Councillor Cordova was referring to, the performance criteria for that clause, it actually meets the acceptable solution. In this case, the acceptable solution is that the visitor accommodation must accommodate guests in existing habitable buildings. This is an existing habitable building. It's approved and has use as a dwelling. And the second part of that is B, have a gross floor area of not more than 200 square metres per lot. The floor area of the visitor accommodation is 140 square metres. Therefore, it meets the acceptable solution. And therefore, the provisions of the performance criteria to which Councillor Cordova referenced are not relevant to the assessment. For this particular application, the only discretion is in relation to the landslide code, because visitor accommodation is considered to be a vulnerable use under the landslide code, and that triggers that discretion, which is assessed in the report on page 104 and top of 105.
Thank you. Ms. Stevenson, Councillor Bastone. Your light is on.
Oh, sorry. through you, Mayor, question to Mrs. Stevenson. On page 107 in the recommendation, it says this permit relates to the use of land or buildings irrespective of the applicant or subsequent occupants. Now, subsequent occupant could be someone that's in there for 2 days, someone that's in there for 2 weeks. How are we going to control these occupants as against the people that own the property? The occupant means the person who is staying in the property, does it not?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. Basically, that's a standard condition that we apply to all planning permits. And effectively what it's saying is that this permit is a permit that's being issued to the applicant who applied for that, but the permit runs with the land and anyone who is using, occupying or undertaking that use on that site is subject to the controls within and the conditions within that planning permit where they're relevant. So the conditions regarding the accommodation, the note is not staying for any more than 3 months, parking in the designated parking areas, and the use and development must be managed so that the amenity of the area is not detrimentally impacted. So those conditions 2, 3 and 4 in the recommendation would apply to the people who are using that that visitor accommodation. So it's just saying that the permit applies to the land and anyone who uses or undertakes that use on that site.
Sorry. So anyone who undertakes using it for accommodation or anyone who is accommodated on the land?
Mr. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. In effect, yes, because the use that's approved is visitor accommodation, but it's only approved provided that it complies with the conditions in the permit, and those conditions require certain things to be done. So if that use is being undertaken in a manner contrary to the permit, then potentially there would be opportunity for compliance action to be taken for non-compliance with the planning permit conditions.
Okay, because I was looking at on page 108... 2C, the emission of noise, artificial light, smoke, i.e. the, you know, outdoor fire pit or whatever. So the applicant who is going to own the B&B or the short-term accommodation has to provide an assurance to us that the people who are staying on the property will not have the outside lights on, will not be making a noise, will not be doing the smoke, or is our grievance with the people who are actually doing it.
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. So most of those issues are also controlled regardless of planning permit conditions through things like the noise regulations and the Environmental Management Pollution Control Act. So there are obligations on all property owners in relation to impacts from noise, from lights, from smoke and so forth. So anyone using that property would be subject to compliance with those. So normal complaints in relation to noise and things like that would go, you know, probably to the police in the first instance, and certainly potentially through council environmental health offices if there was ongoing issues, and that certainly could be investigated through that way. So from the owner or manager of that site's perspective, you know, they are required to ensure that the use of that site is in accordance with the planning permit conditions and any other regulations, just as any property owner would be, and presumably they would need to ensure and pass that on in their policies or their terms of conditions, terms and conditions of people renting that property, but that would be a matter obviously for them how they manage that. But most places would have, you know, terms and conditions, like you stay in any hotel, any visitor accommodation anywhere.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Bastone. I've got Councillor Grace and then Councillor Midgley.
Yes, I'm not sure how many applications we've rejected without a full fire safety report, because on page 106, 1.15, the subject property is located within a bushfire-prone area, but it does not have any firefighting water storages. Visitors are unlikely to be aware about the bushfire risk in the area and might undertake risky behaviours such as lighting outdoor fires, using barbecues, fire pits, throwing cigarette butts, etc. Well, we haven't got a fire report with this particular application, so therefore, how can we be sure that they're going to manage that fire risk? And as I said before, sitting around this table as a planning authority, I don't know how many applications in my time we have rejected because there has been no fire risk assessment by a qualified person.
Thank you, Councillor Grace. I will ask Mrs. Stevenson. My understanding is that there aren't any explicit requirements in the planning scheme for when there's a change of use from dwelling to visitor accommodation, but there is advice contained in the permit at clauses F and, yeah, clause F that asks the applicant to get accredited, an accredited bushfire practitioner to provide some advice. But Mrs. Stevenson, did you want to provide any further clarification?
Through you, Mayor, and I think you've effectively covered it. The planning scheme doesn't trigger the bushfire prone areas code because visitor accommodation is not considered to be a vulnerable use under that code. A little bit confusing because under the landslide code it is a vulnerable use. Under the bushfire code it's not a vulnerable use. Therefore, there is no provisions within the planning scheme that would enable us to require anything in relation to bushfire. We provide that advice because obviously we want to make sure that anyone undertaking that use is aware of their requirements for bushfire. It is a little bit different to, say, a dwelling and things where you're building a new building where you need a building permit, because at that stage the building surveyor would probably pick up on it. If they require a change of use under the building surveyor would probably pick up on it, but we just provide it for their advice to make sure they do their due diligence to make sure they're compliant.
Thank you, Ms. Stevenson. Councillor Midgley, you had your light on earlier.
Thank you very much. Mayor, just a further question for Ms. Stevenson regarding that upgrade. So we recommend them to do it, but as it says in FA2, upgrading of the access or water supply is recommended to bring the development into compliance with current requirements, but there is nothing in the planning scheme that can stipulate them to make them do that. It's just that we recommend it.
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. We're not actually recommending that they upgrade it. We're recommending that they get advice from an accredited bushfire practitioner to determine if there is any need to upgrade it. So it's possible that, given there are a number of dwellings already constructed utilising that access, that the access is up to standard to meet bushfire requirements. So it may be that there isn't anything that's required to be done. Our advice is we recommend you seek advice from a practitioner as to what may or may not need to be done.
Thank you, but they don't need to do anything and we can't make them do anything.
We can't under the planning scheme.
Thank you. Just a couple of points. I'd like to note that I think a holiday home is very different to a visitor accommodation in regards to usability. A holiday home can be something that you might use once or twice a year, but a visitor accommodation can be booked out and utilised every day of the year. And we also don't know that this, if this was previously a home and a residence to someone, and then the new owners turned it from a holiday home to a visitor accommodation. So I just wanted to note that as well. I know it's a bit outside of the planning scheme. In regards to on page 108, it is 4, I think. Yep, recommendation 4. Guests must park within the designated car parking area for the subject site. I note, and I've had a personal experience of that sometimes, when you stay in visitor accommodation, you might have more than one car. Is there any street parking that is available?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. Given that this is an internal lot that's some considerable distance from the road, I'd be very surprised if anyone would want to park on the street and walk up that driveway. But the site itself is quite a large site. I mean, it's, I'm not sure off the top of my head how big it is, but it's about 3,000 odd square metres, I think. Usually you'll find within sites like that that there would be sufficient parking. The assessment was that they only need one parking space under the planning scheme to satisfy the planning scheme requirements. Usually there'd be sufficient room within the site, within the driveway, with a property of that size and that length of driveway. Even if you're jockey parking, it really doesn't matter because the people that would be there would be related to each other, obviously. So from a planning scheme point of view, it meets the requirements of the planning scheme and I wouldn't envisage there'd be any parking issues on a site like that.
Certainly the photo on page 102 seems to indicate you could get two cars in the garage there, small ones.
Thank you. Just noting that sometimes for visitor accommodation that does become a problem and a traffic hazard on the road. The next one in regards to 4C, the permit does not include approval for any signage to be erected on site. Further approval may be required for the erection of signage on the site. Just that may be. So will it be or won't it be and how will it may be?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. There are some exemptions for signs within the planning scheme. It depends largely on the size of them, but there are visitor accommodation signage of a fairly small size that's exempt under the scheme. So it depends, obviously, whether they're A, proposing any signage, B, what they're proposing in terms of the size of that as to whether it would meet any the exemptions under the scheme or whether it would trigger the need for a permit. So we don't know because they haven't proposed anything. So, again, it's just an advice because often people don't think about signage when they're putting their planning applications in and then suddenly they start using and think, oh, we need a sign. So we put that there as advice to make sure they come back to us to check whether they need a permit for what they might want to do.
Thank you. Yes, it's mostly you need a sign sometimes to find visitor accommodation as long as it's not in fluoro lights, and it's great to see that there is approvals around that. There was just in the report something that I hadn't seen before was the, the covenants on title. That was, I guess, new to me. Is there anything that we need to get from that information or...?
Can you give us what page?
So on page 116, the schedule of easements on title. As it is not my areas of qualifications, just if there's anything we need to note or why that was included.
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. So it's standard practice as far as planning applications is concerned to check the titles to see what restrictions may or may not exist on a title. Many titles have covenants on them, which are often put in place by developers, subdividers at the time and have certain requirements. These days we don't let sort of private developers put private type covenants onto titles, but historically there's been a large number of those. So we do, as part of our assessment, we check against the covenants to see whether or not what's being proposed is consistent with those. So this is just part of the checklist that we do to go through those. And as you can see, there is an assessment of what the permits what the covenants are. So these are fairly standard sort of covenants that people used to put on years ago. So things like not being able to have businesses, trades, and advertising signs that are, it's fairly subjective in a lot of ways because it talks about any similar erection of an unsightly nature. Not quite sure what that necessarily means, but certainly we've got our own standards under the planning scheme in terms of what is or isn't appropriate for signage. The other things that these covenants have got are in relation to construction materials, but in this case the building is existing and it's a change of use only, so there's no development. But if they were building new buildings, we would assess those against those covenants as well.
Thank you. There's nothing in the covenant that states these buildings, these dwellings cannot be used for visitor accommodation type.
No, there's not.
Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Councillor Grace, do you have a question? Because you've made your contribution.
It is a question, guaranteed.
Good, excellent.
With fire risk, is it in a high risk fire zone area?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Through you, Mayor. The bushfire prone areas code overlay does apply to this site. There is no, as far as the planning scheme is concerned, there's no differentiation. It's either within a bushfire prone area or it's not. The risks associated with that would be subject to assessment by the accredited bushfire practitioner. So from the scheme's perspective, it is within a bushfire prone area.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just before, I think everybody has made a contribution. Just before I hand back to Councillor Street, I just wanted to touch on something that Councillor Cordova raised in relation to some of the issues that had been raised during the public consultation and the representations. And yes, this was certainly another DA that we have before us tonight that we received a number of representations on, and I appreciate everyone taking the time to share their feelings on this. My reading of this was, and the responses with the issues that were raised, like privacy and security and noise and a range of them, property safety, et cetera, is that all of those things that have been raised in good faith, I know, by representers, but they are outside of the planning scheme. Is that correct for the majority of those?
Through you, Mayor. Effectively, yes. There are obviously matters relating to noise, so there is a standard within the scheme in relation to noise, but that the acceptable solution standards would not be exceeded by something that of this nature. In relation to the other matters, I'm just having a quick look at them. The trespassing and the security and things like that, they're just not matters that they have their own legislation and own separate things, so they're just not matters the planning scheme covers.
Thank you. And just briefly then, I just wanted to remind members that one of the difficulties that we do have and one of the things that that we always need to grapple with when we're sitting as a planning authority right now, not as a council, is that we can only assess a development application on the merits against the planning scheme. And there are issues here that we know are of concern from members of the public, but they are not issues that are contained in the planning scheme that we can take in consideration when voting on this development application. And if we do otherwise and don't have a good, aren't assessing appropriately against the planning scheme and refuse something, then we will end up costing potentially a lot of
money in legal fees that ratepayers do have to foot the bill if we go down a slippery pathway of endorsing something whether we like it or don't like it, or for reasons outside of the planning scheme. And I know that is something that is very difficult for the community to understand, those two roles that we do play, but that is the reality. So I'm happy with the advice that we've been given by our expert planner, and I'll ask Councillor Mitchell, do you have another question?
Thank you, Mayor. I just wanted to make a question point.
Make it a question.
A question that... in reference to your planning tribunal, if we do refuse, has there been experiences sometimes where then we do approve it, but the developer can take counsel to the planning tribunal because of the recommendations?
Mrs. Stevenson.
Sorry, the conditions.
Yes, through you, Mayor. In terms of appeal rights, so if Council's decision is to approve the application, any representative has the right to appeal against that approval. Likewise, the applicant has the right to appeal against any condition imposed within that permit. And if Council were to refuse the application, then the applicant would have the right to appeal against that refusal.
Yep. Thank you. Councillor Street, if you would like to sum up, please.
Thank you, Mayor. Start by reiterating the point that you make about Council sitting as planning authority and it being a difficult position for Council to be in, sitting as planning authority, assessing development applications against the planning scheme. And ultimately, if a development application fits within the planning scheme, there being very little that Council sitting as a planning authority can do in those situations. In this case, our professional advice is that the proposal satisfies all of the relevant acceptable solutions under the scheme, bar one, being the landslide code, where we have to go to the performance criteria. And Councillor Cordova is right. There is a discretion in relation to that matter. But the point that I take is this. It's not an unfettered discretion. It's a discretion that's fettered by the actual performance criteria themselves. And again, the professional advice that we have from staff is that this development application fits within those performance criteria. And on that basis, I don't see that Council, sitting as a planning authority, has any option but to approve this development application. It fits within the planning scheme. And, Mayor, remove the hyperbole and invective from the situation. That is the situation that we are faced with as planning authority. And the last thing that I will say is this. It is very clearly close to election time, judging by some of the contributions that I've heard so far.
Point of order relevance. Please, point of order relevance. I'm fascinated to hear this is relevant to the proposal that's before us. Is an election relevant to the planning scheme? I'm interested.
You've taken a few latitudes yourself today about skyscrapers and bird strikes in New York, so...
If you allow me to finish the sentence, Mayor, I'll show you how it's relevant. And my word to anybody who is watching this debate on the development applications this evening is be very careful about anybody who just tells you what you want to hear and doesn't also tell you about the important place that Council has sitting as a planning authority in relation to the planning scheme and applications made under it.
Thank you, Councillor Street. I'm going to put the recommendation now, moved by Councillor Street, seconded by Councillor Westwood. It's as printed on page 107. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against?
Aye.
I'll have a show of hands. Of those in favour, is Councillors Wass, Midgley, Street, Bastone, Westwood and Reet. Those against, Councillors Grace and Cordova. The motion is carried. The Planning Authority now adjourns at 7:02 p.m. and the open session of Council commences at 7:02 p.m. Turning now to page 118, petitions still being actioned. There are no petitions still being actioned and there were no petitions received in the last period. We now move to, still on page 118, rate remission for Caylus Margate Development with a recommendation on page 121. I'm looking for a mover and a seconder, and so that there can be no confusion about what the recommendation is. The recommendation is that the request for a rate remission for the Catalyst Group be denied. Do I have a mover and a seconder? Moved, Councillor Cordova, seconded, Councillor Westwood. Councillor Cordova.
Thank you, Mayor. I'm pleased with the recommendation listed at item 10 on page 121 that the request for a rate remission for the Catalyst Group be denied, and I'll be supporting this motion to deny a rate remission for the Catalyst Group. Furthermore, even if the proposed rates remission were able to be ring-fenced for the supermarket, I think that lots of Kingborough residents rightly would be scratching their heads about that, why a supermarket like IGA or Coles or Woolworths should get a rate remission of much less $45,000 per year or pro rata equivalent, as is suggested in the proposed recommendation there. There's a lot of ratepayers I know who aren't looking forward to the rising cost of living, and they could do with a $45,000 per year leg up. So council should not be in the business of giving corporate welfare to supermarkets. We should be in the business of putting the community at the heart of everything we do, which is why I am pleased to see the recommendation here to deny this rates remission. When a corporation, any corporation, undertakes business in a given area, they need to be cognisant of their responsibilities to the community in which they operate. It is not equitable for one business to receive special treatment from council by getting a rate remission that others do not get, which in turn spreads the costs of council's operations and services across to other ratepayers. The fact that the business in question owns skyrise buildings in the CBD, more than a dozen bottle shops, major hotels, rooftop restaurants and shopping centres in Kingston merely added to the community discontent, which was voiced to me by numerous constituents. The common refrain was, I'm expected to pay my rates fair and square. Why should they be any different? The staff have told us on numerous occasions that this development will happen one way or the other. The growth of Margate is such that there is already a strong business case for development, and if this developer has chosen not to develop this site, despite that clear business case, well, that's a reputational issue for them. The potential motion listed on page 120 of this agenda item is fundamentally untenable and absolutely will not stand in the eyes of the public because it suggests a rate remission of up to $45,000 per annum or the equivalent pro rata. The entire community grants budget for Kingborough is only $30,000 in the upcoming year, and I simply cannot fathom having to try to explain to members of whether it's the Kettering Community Association or the Loaves and Fishes Tasmania, the Echidnas Volleyball Club, Little Athletics or Lifesaving, the Taruna Environment Network or Net Zero Channel Action Group, I couldn't explain to them how it is that council plans to spend 150% of the entire community grants budget in one year just to prop up one of Tasmania's largest private developers in what can best be described as corporate welfare. I believe that even by entertaining the initial request as took place on the 6th of June, we've done council no great favours in the eyes of the public. I hope it is noted, as you can see for yourselves from the minutes of the meeting of the 6th of June 2022, that it was only Councillor Fox and myself who tried to bin this request for allowing council to give public money in a corporate handout, and I admonished the council group I admonished the Callis Group for their hubristic behaviour. I actually welcome the development in the Margate CBD, and it's coming not a moment too soon. In fact, it's coming a bit too late, and I wish all of the owners and operators there the utmost of success. This is a wonderful thing. It could be a wonderful thing for the Margate CBD and our residents. I hope that Council can serve them as we do all ratepayers in Kingborough, and we continue to keep the community at the heart of everything we do. But we must also act in accordance with our organisational values of accountability, respect, excellence and inclusiveness. And to give a business a financial freebie and deny the same rates relief to other businesses in direct competition on the very same stretch of road, that would not be in line with our values of inclusiveness. It would have been an exclusive giveaway to the top end of town. And so I am pleased to vote for a request for the rate remission to the Catalyst Group to be denied. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. Further speakers? Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I'll just be brief. Definitely, I agree with this motion. The community sentiment is loud and clear. It's great that we got a report with the full details in regards to the finances. Very big no. I think let's just hope that they get on with it. And I'd like to see that these rates were put forward to an upgrade or look at the Margate Precinct Plan and things like that. So that's where I stand on this.
Thank you, Councillor Midgley. Further speakers? Councillor Grace.
I disagree, of course. I'm not going to get overwrapped in this because if we look at the report That was presented to us on the 6th of June. I argued my case there. May I have written proof here, a letter sent out to the public on the 23rd of October 2012 with the design of the roundabout, etc., etc., Margate. And here we have another one on the 13th of August. That one was transferring of land between the Cullis Group and the Kingborough Council, which the Cullis Group agreed to do for the council at that time. Paul West was the general manager at that time, to allow council to get on with the improvements of the road network at Margate, particularly the roundabout, etc. I think we all got an email from the Cullis Group regarding them pointing out quite strongly that they never got any gain whatsoever. They have not received any funds from council regarding that Margate development. I will end it there because the proof's here in writing, which I'm astonished that other councillors haven't got it, because this goes back well before 2011, when the application first came to council for the shopping centre. The councillors voted against it, and it was recommended by our planning scheme. So we talk about having to take notice of our planning scheme, so you can understand now my inconsistency within this council over the years I've sat around this table. If that's the decision council want to make, this is up to you, the council. I am appalled by that, because we have given concessions, large concessions, which we'll, I'll be writing to Council General Manager in the next few days, asking for a full report on how much we've propped up other developments in Kingston and Blackmans Bay or wherever, because I will pursue this in another manner. The development is a very important development for Kingborough. It will employ somewhere around about 100 construction workers, and I believe up to probably 200 employees. They're our young adults in our municipality, quite a lot on part-time, but it will also create a lot of permit work. And I'm very surprised that we can't see that as a council and try and help assist down at Margate. I don't know. I've been told today that the whole thing, depending on tonight, might be closed down again. And that's quite possible, because the contractor told me today he has not got a contract. He's only got a contract to do certain things until this is dealt with council tonight. If that's the case, I would probably guarantee council that that hole will sit in the ground for another 10 years, and that would be most disappointing. I don't want to really criticise, but I do take a point on Councillor Cordover. Our role, as Councillor Street pointed out, and I'll finish in time in a minute, but our role is to look at this in a professional way. It's not our business to make our decision on what the developer owns or what he doesn't own. That's got nothing to do with it, because there's nowhere in the report saying he owns 20 bottle shops or 50. And Mayor, I will leave it at that. I am very disappointed. The ratepayers that I have spoken to, once I explain to them that we've done it elsewhere,
time.
2 seconds.
That's 2 seconds gone.
They're quite happy for us to give a recession.
Thank you, Councillor Grace. Councillor Midgley.
Thank you, Mayor. I have to ask a further question in regards to what Councillor Grace has said. So this is a remission, 2 years, $45,000 per annum. That, do staff believe that that would, if we do not make the decision tonight, therefore that hold them up from continuing progress?
Can we just... okay. We just need to clarify what that is not what they asked for. You may recall that that the Kalis Group asked for 20 years of rates relief to a total value of over $1 million. And perhaps because I'm still suffering from COVID brain, perhaps the General Manager can just refresh our memory of what that actual total ask was.
Through you, Mayor, it was certainly in that vicinity. Difficult to quantify exactly, but based on construction costs, it would certainly have been, with the original ask, well in excess of $1 million.
A question.
Sure.
Has the General Manager got any idea how much we subsidise Channel Court for, just one project?
General Manager.
Through you, Mayor. No, I don't, Councillor Grace. But what I do know is that, having been the General Manager of this Council since February 2014, I cannot recall any other developer being subsidised in that way since 2014.
I think at the time when we had a discussion about... Well, when we had the discussion about this back in June, we did discuss the fact that there used to be a policy that existed, like an economic development sort of rates relief policy that existed back in the early 2000s, and that was because there was so much lack of development within the Kingston CBD. It was before Channel Court had been developed, it was before the plaza had been developed, etc., etc. So there was at that time, and that's, I think there's only one or two people who are on council now who were around then. There was some relief given, but it was found that as the economy picked up, there was no need for council to continue to provide financial assistance for developers. And we are in a situation here where there was a development application that was passed by the Kalis Group in 2013 for development at Margate, and the block has been sitting undeveloped since then. So I think that is the difficulty that we face, but I think that the concern in the community very much is that for a developer to ask Kingborough Council for over $1 million, which is what we estimate that ask to be, and for us as a council to lock in subsequent councils to a 20-year agreement is too much. I had, you know, had some hope that perhaps there would be a way that we could get through this, but I think that was certainly too big an ask, and something that we can't afford as a council. So that's my comments. Councillor Westwood.
Thank you, Mayor. Just to reiterate, the recommendation is that the request for a rate remission for the Kalis Group be denied. We have had, as has been outlined, a number of discussions about this, including discussion at a workshop and discussion at a previous council meeting. The request we're talking about is not a request for two lots of $45,000. The request is for 20 years of rates relief to a private developer, as well as a remission on the fees and charges that council charges as a cost recovery exercise. I agree with Councillor Cordova that this is inappropriate. Following our discussion at a council meeting a couple of months ago, we did receive a large number of submissions and feedback from the community expressing their displeasure that we would consider something like this. I have personally not had one single ratepayer approach me to say they thought it was a good idea. So we have certainly tested the water. We have discussed this deliberately in an open session of council so that we are being open and transparent about a 20-year request for rates relief that would bind not just ourselves but five lots of subsequently elected groups of 10 elected representatives. I think it would be highly irresponsible of us to consider supporting such requests. I think that the recommendation is appropriate, responsible, and I urge my colleagues to support it.
Thank you, Councillor Westwood. Are there any further speakers? Otherwise, I'll ask Councillor Cordova to sum up.
Thank you, Mayor. I think this has been a constructive discussion, and essentially there has been some discussion about item 15.1 or referring to item 15.1 on the 6th of June, in which there was suggestion that the Callis Group already received $600,000 of financial incentives. So this is, in rebuttal, this is kind of what we heard. The argument is that the building of that roundabout would have happened anyway, and therefore the Callis Group hasn't yet received any kind of financial incentive. That's the argument being made. And the point is this: even if that were true, which it isn't, the Callis Group received, you know, the $600,000 in financial incentives already, but even if it were true that $0 had been given in incentive to the Callis Group, the fundamental point is that at this time, with the cost of living rising, with people facing such hardships at home, it is inappropriate to be giving developers, funneling public money through the council by way of discounts or subsidies or what have you, to a private developer who's one of the largest private developers in Tasmania, and it did not meet the pub test. And I think we've all experienced, certainly the correspondence that I've had has been a fundamental opposition to the idea of giving, whether it's $45,000 per year discount or whether it's $1 million over 20 years discount, it doesn't matter. The community isn't up for their money to be spent in this way. There are plenty of really important things that council can be doing, and this isn't one of them. But I just want to conclude by saying that I think now that we've considered this at length, and I appreciate the way in which we've done that, I think now we need to put this request aside, and we need to now acknowledge and embrace this new development, which should be a good thing for the community and should be a good thing for businesses. It should revitalise the CBD, and I look forward to that vibrant, dynamic, clean and green city centre for Margate. And as Councillor Midgley alluded to, I think there's some exciting possibilities with the Margate precinct plan as well. So I think there are good things coming out of this, but this was not the right request to be made, and I think Council's making the right decision in denying this request. Thank you.
Thank you, Councillor Cordova. I'm going to put the recommendation now as printed on page 121, and that is that the request for rates and remuneration for the Callis Group at the Margate development be denied. All those in favour?
Aye.
Against? A show of hands is required. All those in favour? Is Councillors Cordova, Wass, Midgley, Street, Bastone, Westwood and Reet. And those against, Councillor Grace. The motion is carried. The time being 7:20, we've still got quite a bit to do. I'm just going to call a short recess. If you can, please keep it to 5 minutes. That would be appreciated. So we'll come back in 5 minutes.